Chapter 12. Germ Games. War Games. Genesis of the Biosecurity State. Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Benjamin Franklin. Many of us are pondering when things will return to normal. The short response is, never. Nothing will ever return to the broken sense of normalcy that prevailed prior to the crisis, because the coronavirus pandemic marks a fundamental inflection point in our global trajectory. Klaus Schwab, The Great Reset, July 2020. I want to be straight with you. There will be no return to the old normal for the foreseeable future. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, World Health Organization Director General. History of Bioweapons. The United States began its first large-scale offensive bioweapons research during World War II in the spring of 1943 on orders from President Franklin Roosevelt as a collaboration between the U.S. military and its pharmaceutical industry partners. Pharma titan George W. Merck ran the Pentagon's offensive bioweapons program while simultaneously directing his drug manufacturing behemoth. Merck boasted that his team could deliver biowarfare agents without vast expenditures or constructing huge facilities. Another advantage of bioweapons, he remarked, was that their development could proceed under the guise of legitimate medical research. The intelligence agencies were involved in the top-secret program from the outset. George Merck's hands-on employee, Frank Olson, was an American bacteriologist, biological warfare scientist, and CIA officer. He worked for the United States Army Biological Warfare Laboratories, USBWL, at Fort Detrick with Merck and the U.S. military, developing the U.S. bioweapons and psi warfare arsenal. Project Artichoke was an experimental CIA interrogation program that used psychoactive drugs like LSD in pursuit of enhanced interrogation methods. The project was part of a larger CIA program exploring approaches for controlling both individuals and populations. Olson was involved with Project Artichoke with moral misgivings, beginning in May 1952. After watching a documentary on Protestant Reformation leader Martin Luther, a conscience-stricken Olson informed his bosses he intended to quit the biowarfare program. Around the time of that announcement, Olson's CIA colleague Sidney Gottlieb, head of the CIA's MK-Ultra program, covertly dosed him with LSD. A week later, on November 28, 1953, Olson plunged to his death from a window of New York's Hotel Statler. The U.S. government first described his death as a suicide and then as misadventure. In 1975, the government admitted its guilt in the murder and offered Olson's family an out-of-court settlement of $1,250,000, later reduced to $750,000, which they accepted with an official apology from President Gerald Ford and then CIA Director William Colby. By 1969, the U.S. bioweapons program had developed weapons of a nuclear equivalence, according to David Franz, who for 23 years served as commander of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRIID. The principal limitation, Franz acknowledged, was the difficulty of managing bioweapons so as to prevent accidental escape. Ironically, Franz would later play a key role in the Pentagon Fauci gain-of-function programs leading up to the COVID-19 pandemic. It all ended, seemingly, in late 1969, when President Nixon traveled to Fort Detrick to announce the closure of America's bioweapons program for moral and strategic reasons. America signed the Biological Weapons Convention in 1972, forbidding development, use, and stockpiling of biological weapons, and mothballed most of its labs. But the agreement, a supplement to the Geneva Convention, left thousands of scientists, military contractors, and Pentagon caliphs as stranded assets yearning for the program's revival. The treaty also included a yawning loophole. It allowed production of anthrax and other biological warfare agents for vaccine production. The Pentagon and CIA spooks continued to cultivate bioweapon seed stock. Between 1983 and 1988, Searle Pharmaceuticals CEO Donald Rumsfeld, acting as Ronald Reagan's envoy in Iraq, arranged for the top-secret shipment of tons of chemical and biological armaments, including anthrax and bubonic plague, to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, hoping to reverse his looming defeat by Iran's million-man army. Ayatollah Khomeini's victorious Iranian forces were then routing Saddam in their war over the Persian Gulf. The Bush administration feared the impact on global oil supplies if Iran prevailed in that conflict. The birth of the biosecurity agenda. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1988 to 1991, the military-industrial complex began rummaging about for a more reliable enemy to permanently justify its hefty share of the GDP. While most Americans eagerly awaited the ballyhooed peace dividend, Pentagon mandarins and their emporium of contractors may have considered with dismay that someone else would be spending money that was rightfully theirs. The peace dividend never materialized. Beginning with the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993 and culminating in 9/11, Islamic terrorism replaced the Soviets as the essential adversary in U.S. foreign policy. It may have provided solace to the military and its contractors that terrorism was a more reliable long-term foe than the Soviets. Since terrorism is a tactic, not a nation, an imprecisely defined terrorism had the allure of an enemy that could never be vanquished. We can imagine the defense contractors' relief when Vice President Dick Cheney declared the Long War, one he promised would last for generations, with battlegrounds scattered in more than 50 nations. Military contractors held tight to their gravy train with the mission of building an expensive new arsenal of anti-terror technologies. But terrorism had its own shortfall, namely the challenge of sustaining public fear sufficient to justify spending substantial portions of GDP to meet a threat that killed fewer Americans annually than lightning strikes. By 1999, some far-sighted Pentagon planners were already looking ahead to the more exuberant and sustainable prosperity that would come with a war on germs. Most historians date the nativity of the modern biosecurity agenda to the October 2001 anthrax attacks. But years earlier, military and medical industrial complex planners were already conceptualizing biosecurity as a potent strategy for leveraging potential pandemics or bioterrorism into vast funding increases and as a device for metamorphosing America, the world's exemplary democracy, into a national security state with global dominance. Robert Kadlec, Let the Games Begin. Bioweapons expert Robert P. Kadlec is an American physician and retired colonel in the United States Air Force who served as Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services for Preparedness and Response from August 2017 until January 2021. And who managed the COVID-19 crisis during the Trump administration. Second only to his longtime crony and comrade-in-arms Anthony Fauci, Robert Kadlec played an historic leadership role in fomenting the contagious logic that infectious disease posed a national security threat requiring a militarized response. Since the 1993 World Trade Center terror attack, Kadlec had been evangelizing about an imminent anthrax attack that would doom the American way of life. In the mid-1990s, Kadlec served as part of an elite Air Force operations unit of UN weapons inspectors, fruitlessly hunting the Iraqi desert for Saddam Hussein's suspected stores of anthrax and botulism following the first Persian Gulf War. At 2:47 in the early morning of February 1, 2020, 4 hours after his loyal grantee, virologist Christian Anderson, informed Dr. Fauci that he and other leading biologists believed that the genetic sequence responsible for the furin cleave on the virus's spike protein, the peculiar structure that allows the organism to bind tightly to and infect cells with the ACE2 receptor, was highly unlikely to be the product of natural selection, Dr. Anthony Fauci fired a carefully worded email to Kadlec. Dr. Fauci's other emails from that evening suggest that he was intensely worried that the Chinese experiments that may have created this striation in the novel coronavirus would bear his fingerprints. If Dr. Fauci's gain-of-function research had indeed minted COVID-19, then Kadlec would also be implicated. Kadlec served on the small so-called P3CO committee charged with approving NIH's gain-of-function experiments, and it is clear from Dr. Fauci's email that the subject was also on Kadlec's mind. Dr. Fauci attached an article to his email to Kadlec. It was Bat Lady Xi Zhengli's deceitful effort to downplay the laboratory leak hypothesis. "Bob, this just came out today," Dr. Fauci told his gain-of-function confederate. "Gives a balanced view." Subsequent events proved that the author of that article was deliberately lying to conceal the Wuhan lab's manipulation of coronavirus pathogens that were nearly identical to the microbe that caused COVID-19. Both Kadlec and Fauci had been involved, for over a decade, in promoting and funding these dangerous experiments through NIAID and the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA, the biosecurity funding agency that Kadlec had helped create, including funneling millions of dollars in U.S. funding to Xi, the hapless writer of the exculpatory article. Dr. Fauci's email shows these two technocrats and others patching together evidence for the dubious official story that they would tell the world. Over the next few weeks, Dr. Fauci would pull the reliable old levers that he had manipulated for decades to transform convenient canards into official orthodoxies. The contrived cosmologies he thereby constructed would hold for a full year before they finally began to unravel. Kadlec is a Dr. Strangelove knockoff with deep ties to spy agencies, Big Pharma, the Pentagon, and military contractors who profiteer from the spread of bioweapons alarmism. Intelligence agency historian and journalist Whitney Webb describes Kadlec as a man enmeshed in the world of intelligence, military intelligence, and corporate corruption, dutifully fulfilling the vision of his friends in high places and behind closed doors. In 1998, Kadlec created an internal strategy paper for the Pentagon, promoting the development of pandemic pathogens as a stealth weapon that the Pentagon could deploy against its enemies without leaving fingerprints. Biological weapons under the cover of an endemic or natural disease occurrence provides an attacker the potential for plausible denial. Biological warfare's potential to create significant economic losses and consequent political instability, coupled with plausible deniability, exceeds the possibilities of any other human weapon, he wrote. Kadlec, in 1999, organized his paranoia into several illustrative scenarios to demonstrate the United States' vulnerability to biological attack. In one of Kadlec's doomsday fantasies dubbed corn terrorism, China clandestinely sprays corn seed blight over the Midwest from commercial airliners. Kadlec warns China gains significant corn market share and tens of billions of dollars of additional profits from their crop, while leaving the U.S. corn belt in ruin. Another Kadlec scenario, titled Lousy Wine, envisions disgruntled European winemakers covertly releasing grape lice concealed in cans of pâté to target California wine producers. In an April 2001 study for the National Defense University National War College, Kadlec urgently recommended the creation of a strategic national stockpile to warehouse countermeasures including vaccines and antibiotics, and recommended regulatory changes to provide for mandatory vaccinations and coercive quarantines in the event of a pandemic. Those ideas helped win him an appointment as Special Assistant for Biodefense Planning to President George W. Bush after the post-September 11th anthrax attacks later that same year. From this sinecure, Kadlec's fervent lobbying persuaded Congress to establish a strategic national stockpile, whose contents are currently worth $7 billion. Kadlec would come to control purchases for that stockpile and, following the lead of his comrades Bill Gates and Tony Fauci, he would use that power to enrich his vaccine industry friends and sideline public health. As journalist Alexis Baden-Mayer observed, Kadlec created the biodefense industrial complex as we know it, and he rules it like a czar. The Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci-funded biosecurity. Let the war games begin. In 1999, Dr. Kadlec organized a simulation of a smallpox terrorist attack on U.S. soil for a joint exercise by the newly formed Johns Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Strategies and the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. The founder of the center was D.A. Henderson, famed for leading the program that eradicated smallpox in 1977. The senior fellow and co-founder of the Johns Hopkins Center was a CIA spook and pharmaceutical industry lobbyist named Tara O'Toole. She took over as chief when Henderson left. The third center director was Tom Inglesby, who remains in that role. In 1999, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation committed $20 million to Johns Hopkins to establish the Bill and Melinda Gates Institute for Population and Reproductive Health. For the next two decades, Gates would direct a vast stream of funding to the enterprise of elevating biosecurity as the national priority. Some of his most visible investments funded a series of simulations presided over by Inglesby at his Johns Hopkins Center. Those simulations would make Inglesby the congenial face of biosecurity paranoia, feed the burgeoning biodefense industry, and help lay the foundation for the modern security state. The deal pipeline from NIH and NIAID to Johns Hopkins, an astonishing $13 billion since 2001, dwarfs Gates' contributions to the school. But shoddy or perhaps deliberately obscure reporting makes it nearly impossible to determine how many of these dollars flowed to Inglesby and his center. Kadlec's simulations, and over a dozen that would succeed it over the next 20-plus years, many under Bill Gates's direction, shared common features. None of them emphasized protecting public health by showing Americans how to bolster their immune systems, to eat well, to lose weight, to exercise, to maintain vitamin D levels, and to avoid chemical exposure. None of these focused on devising the vital communications infrastructures to link frontline doctors during a pandemic or to facilitate the development and refinement of optimal treatment protocols. None of these dealt seriously with the need to identify off-the-shelf, now known as repurposed therapeutic drugs, to mitigate fatalities and to shorten a pandemic's duration. None of them considered ways to isolate the sick and protect the vulnerable, or how to shield people in nursing homes and other institutions from infection. None of them questioned the efficacy of masks, lockdowns, and social distancing in reducing casualties. None of them engaged in soul-searching about how to preserve constitutional rights during a global pandemic. Instead, the simulations war-gamed how to use police powers to detain and quarantine citizens, how to impose martial law, how to control messaging by deploying propaganda, how to employ censorship to silence dissent, and how to mandate masks, lockdowns, and coercive vaccinations, and conduct track and trace surveillance among potentially reluctant populations. Coercion should be the last strategy to consider in a pandemic, remarked physician and biological warfare expert Merrill Nass, MD. If you have a remedy that works, people will flock to get it. It's troubling that the first and only option was creating a police state. The still unsolved mystery of the post-9/11 anthrax attacks. Contemporaneously with Johns Hopkins' smallpox simulation, the Pentagon launched a top-secret project at a former nuclear weapons site in the Nevada desert to test the feasibility of building a small anthrax production facility using off-the-shelf equipment easily available in hardware stores and biological supply catalogs. Codenamed Project Bacchus, a small cohort of faux terrorists, military weapons experts, succeeded in producing a few pounds of anthrax. 2 years after the Pentagon's Nevada anthrax project, someone associated with the United States Army mounted a far-reaching campaign of sending anthrax to members of Congress and key media figures, officially launching the biosecurity era. In the light of subsequent events, we cannot exclude the possibility that someone in our government carried out a false flag attack against Americans as a provocation for some larger agenda. This is not an outlandish conspiracy theory. During my uncle's presidential administration, the Joint Chiefs of Staff submitted a plan termed Operation North Woods, proposing false flag attacks, including mass murders of random American citizens, to justify an invasion of Cuba. My uncle reacted with horror to Joint Chief Chairman Lyman Lemnitzer's North Woods briefing pitch and abruptly walked out of the presentation. "And they call us the human race," he remarked to his Secretary of State, Dean Rusk. U.S. intelligence agencies and military-industrial complex insiders initially, and ultimately wrongly, blamed the 2001 anthrax letter attacks on Saddam Hussein or Al-Qaeda, and later used similarly incorrect pretexts to launch a war against Iraq. The mailing of anthrax introduced Americans to a new enemy, more frightening than garden-variety terrorism. While terrorists could destroy key buildings and airliners, the biosecurity narrative warns that pathogens could enter any American home and invisibly slay its occupants. Germs, therefore, easily outgunned Al-Qaeda as a reliable wellspring of terror. This was the lesson Cadillac had been broadcasting for 5 years. The delivery of anthrax through the mail brought home his jeremiads. By 2020, biosecurity would altogether eclipse Islamic terrorism as the spear tip of U.S. military and foreign policy. The topic of infectious diseases suddenly became the most effective way to open government pockets. Meet the El-Hibri family. In 1998, Lebanese-born financier Ibrahim El-Hibri and his son Fuad, with former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral William Crow Jr., established a corporation called Bioport and paid the state of Michigan $25 million for its aging vaccine manufacturing campus. The purpose the Al-Hibris intended to use the factory for was to manufacture anthrax vaccine for sale to the U.S. military. Al-Hibri Sr. was a longtime associate of both Robert Cadillac and Admiral Crow, who chaired the Joint Chiefs under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. The Al-Hibris had previous success in the anthrax vaccine business, having made a small fortune by purchasing anthrax vaccines made by the UK government and reselling them at 100 times the purchase price to the Saudi Arabian government. Less than a month after taking over the Michigan-based business, Bioport signed an exclusive $29 million contract with the Pentagon to manufacture, test, bottle, and store the anthrax vaccine for American troops stationed abroad. The Secretary of the Army indemnified the factory the day before signing the contract on September 3, 1998. The Al-Hibris never safety tested their concoction. They didn't have to. They had no liability for injuries. 10 months before the Al-Hibris bought the plant, an FDA audit uncovered contamination problems, suspect record-keeping, and assorted security breaches at their laboratory, as well as 9 million stored doses that were adulterated. Almost as soon as Bioport was formed, it began receiving large sums from the U.S. Army to rehabilitate the anthrax plant, but it was still unable to pass an FDA audit. In 1999, they bulldozed the factory and rebuilt it at taxpayer expense. The state of Michigan sweetened the deal, but the FDA would not give its stamp of approval to the new manufacturing facility. Bioport, with a hefty lobbying team and designer furniture in its executive offices, kept crying poor and coming back to the U.S. government for additional handouts before finally falling into a death spiral around the bankruptcy drain in mid-2001. The October 2001 anthrax incidents proved the Al-Hibris' salvation. The Pentagon leveraged the strange attacks, turning them into the long-awaited provocation, justifying the crusade to expand the battlefront in bioweapons research. The 1972 Biological Weapons Convention meant neither the brass nor the spooks could legally research or produce bioweapons. But the convention left open the loophole that signatories could develop dual-use vaccine and weapon technologies so long as the projects had a defensive rationale. After the anthrax attacks, vaccines suddenly became a euphemism for bioweapons and a ticket back to deep water for a beached biowarfare industry. Military planners at the Pentagon, BARDA, DARPA, and the CIA through USAID began pouring money into gain-of-function experiments. Dual-use research was suddenly in vogue. Dark Winter 2001. During June 22nd and 23rd, 2001, less than 3 months before the 9/11 attacks, the Pentagon launched a war game codenamed Operation Dark Winter at Andrews Air Force Base that emphasized the military's earnest commitment to bioweapon vaccines. Robert Cadillac, the lead organizer of this pandemic simulation, also coined its code name. The tabletop scenario simulated a smallpox attack on U.S. locations, beginning in Oklahoma City, the site of a real domestic terror attack in 1995. Dark Winter participants explored strategies for imposing coercive quarantines, censorship, mandatory masking, lockdowns, and vaccination, and expanded police powers as the only rational responses to the pandemic. The failure in the Dark Winter case to quickly implement such countermeasures allowed the galloping spread of the Pentagon's imaginary smallpox epidemic to overwhelm America's response capabilities, precipitating massive civilian casualties, widespread panic, societal breakdown, and mob violence. The Pentagon summary of the exercise concluded that scarcity of vaccines to curtail the contagion spread proved the most severe limitation on management options. The Dark Winter exercise eerily predicted many aspects of what would follow just months later with the anthrax letter attacks. Such uncanny miracles of foreshadowing became a recurring feature of each subsequent germ game. The Spooks and the Simulations. By playing the role of U.S. President, the Senate Defense Committee's longtime chairman, Senator Sam Nunn, a dyed-in-the-wool war hawk, brought prestige, urgency, and a militaristic gestalt to Cadillac's Dark Winter exercise. Most of the other key participants shared Cadillac's intelligence agency pedigrees. CIA involvement was a consistent feature of this and all the subsequent simulations. Other participants included Robert Cadillac's fellow intelligence officer and War College professor, Colonel Randall Larson, USAF, another career bioweapons expert who helped choreograph the exercise and appeared in its fictional scripted news clips. CIA's former director James Woolsey was a participant and organizer, as was a pharmaceutical industry lobbyist and biological weapons expert, Tara O'Toole, a director of the CIA hedge fund InQtel, the CIA's former deputy director for science and technology Ruth David, Hopkins bioterrorism expert Tom Inglesby, and New York Times journalist Judith Miller also participated. James Woolsey's presence, and that of Colonel Larson, Ruth David, and Tara O'Toole, signaled the intelligence community's ubiquitous but shadowy presence in biosecurity and all things vaccine. I sat on a board with Woolsey for several years and am familiar with his deep anxieties about germ warfare. Woolsey's germophobia rivals Cadillac's. Woolsey calls a biological weapons attack the single most dangerous threat to U.S. national security in the foreseeable future. O'Toole is a biodefense enthusiast, co-founder of the Johns Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Studies, and executive vice president at the CIA's investment arm, InQtel. That shady firm is the vector by which U.S. intelligence services infiltrate startup firms on the cutting edge of technological innovation. O'Toole, like her longtime Confederate Cadillac, juggles deep and disturbing relationships with the same retinue of rapacious pharmaceutical industry and military contractors that Cadillac also cultivated. In 2009, when President Obama nominated O'Toole for Undersecretary for Science and Technology at the Department of Homeland Security, Senator John McCain criticized her for concealing her role as strategic director of a pharmaceutical industry lobbying outfit, Alliance Biosciences. Alliance is an unincorporated corporate front group created by Ibrahim El-Hibri and his partner, former Joint Chiefs Chair Admiral William Crow, and funded by other bioweapons firms. Alliance has no tax filing and operates out of a K Street influence shop. The congressional record shows that the Alliance is a so-called stealth lobbying firm that spent $500,000 over 2005 to 2009 pitching Congress and the Homeland Security Department for greater biodefense expenditures, and particularly for anthrax vaccines. Alliance's other funders include Pfizer, the International Pharmaceutical Aerosol Consortium, and SIG Technologies, a biodefense military contractor. O'Toole's nomination to Undersecretary at the Department of Homeland Security also prompted objections from more mainstream bioweapons experts, including the preeminent Rutgers microbiologist Richard Ebright. She was the single most extreme person, either in or out of government, advocating for a massive biodefense expansion and relaxation of provisions for safety and security. Ebright added, "She makes Dr. Strangelove look sane. O'Toole supported every flawed decision and counterproductive policy on biodefense, biosafety, and biosecurity during the Bush administration. O'Toole is as out of touch with reality and paranoiac, it would be hard to think of a person less well-suited for the position. During those same 2009 confirmation hearings, Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan added to the voices of skepticism. Dr. O'Toole fell short of the strict adherence to scientific principles when she was the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Strategies, he said, noting that Dr. O'Toole was one of the principal designers and authors of the June 2001 Dark Winter exercise that simulated a covert attack on the United States by bioterrorists. Levin faulted O'Toole for using the exercise to promote her biosecurity agenda and with hyperbolic pandemic fantasies. But many top scientists have said that the Dark Winter exercise was based on faulty and exaggerated assumptions about the transmission rate of smallpox. Dr. James Koopman of the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Michigan made the ungenerous assessment that O'Toole's enthusiasm for germ warfare had clouded her scientific judgment. Koopman, an expert at modeling the transmission rates of infectious diseases who participated in the smallpox eradication program, complained that Dr. O'Toole has not sought balanced scientific input in her thinking, that she shows a lack of analytic orientation to scientific issues, and that she has generated hype about bioterrorism that she will feel obligated to defend rather than pursue a balanced approach. Dr. Michael Lane, the former director of the Centers for Disease Control Smallpox Eradication Program, likewise condemned O'Toole for padding her assumptions about smallpox transmission rates in Dark Winter, which he characterized as improbable and even absurd. Ironically, even Dr. Fauci, who by then was already the king of embellishing and fabricating pandemics, voiced his disapproval of O'Toole and Cadlick's extreme Dark Winter exaggerations, which Dr. Fauci declared much, much worse than would have been the case in real life. The transmission rate of smallpox was not the only area where Dr. O'Toole and Cadlick ignored facts. On February 19, 2002, O'Toole wrote that many experts believe that the smallpox virus is not confined to these two official repositories, one in the United States and one in Russia, and may be in the possession of states or subnational groups pursuing active biological weapons programs. O'Toole cited a June 13, 1999 New York Times article as the source for her alarming assertion that subnational groups controlled smallpox stocks. But that article included no reference to any non-state group actors possessing any biological weapons. Another key Dark Winter planner and participant was Ruth David, a former deputy director at the CIA. In 1998, David became president of ANSR, a nonprofit corporation with deep ties to the CIA. ANSR played a key role in pushing the government toward homeland security post-9/11 and became a primary promoter of biometric and facial recognition software for U.S. law enforcement agencies. Among other functions, ANSR funds a mysterious defense contractor from South Carolina called Advanced Technology International. ATI somehow became the vector through which the government arranged at least $6 billion of secretive Operation Warp Speed vaccine contracts with Pfizer, Bill Gates's Novavax vaccine, Johnson & Johnson, and Sanofi. Those contracts, comprising the majority of Operation Warp Speed's $10 billion budget, suggest a deep CIA involvement with the COVID-19 vaccine enterprise's cozy deals with Big Pharma. As Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response with HHS, Robert Cadlick personally signed off on those sweetheart deals. The terms allow Operation Warp Speed to completely bypass the regulatory oversight and transparency of traditional federal contracting mechanisms, as NPR put it. In a January 2021 expose, the New York Times dug into Cadlick's secretive vaccine contracts, observing that available documents suggest that drug companies demanded and received flexible delivery schedules, as well as patent protection and immunity from liability if anything goes wrong. In some instances, countries are prohibited from donating or reselling doses, a ban that could hamper efforts to get vaccines to poor countries. Dark winter aftermath. Despite all its hiccups, Dark Winter was an extraordinary success. It foreshadowed the real bioweapons incidents occurring less than 3 months later, inflamed public germophobia, and fortified the official narrative after the first September 18th anthrax attack letters, which pointed fingers at Saddam Hussein and or Al-Qaeda as the probable culprits. Several Dark Winter participants displayed extraordinary prescience in the weeks leading up to the anthrax attacks, along with a relentless determination to pin the caper on Saddam. The anthrax attack's first casualty, Robert Stevens, was hospitalized and diagnosed with anthrax on October 2nd. Highly publicized and laudatory Senate hearings on the Dark Winter simulation that began on October 1st, 2001, 3 days before the anthrax attacks became public knowledge, functioned to imbue U.S. government officials, the national press, and the public with Dark Winter's paranoid assumptions and to assign the blame to Saddam. Another Dark Winter planner, Jerome Hauer, along with spymaster James Woolsey and New York Times reporter Judith Miller, spent the 3 weeks between 9/11 and October 4th banging the gong about imminent anthrax attacks, carpet bombing the television talk shows, kibitzing on the nightly news, and gabbing up the Sunday morning TV gas bags. Judith Miller received special assistance in this task from her employer, the New York Times, which published her numerous alarmist reports and warnings about coming biological attacks on American soil. Incredibly, the attack arrived exactly as Miller, Hauer, and Woolsey predicted, and with exquisite timing, smack in the middle of the U.S. Senate hearings over America's vulnerability to an anthrax attack. Hauer, a bioterrorism expert and pharmaceutical industry operative, is currently an executive with Teneo, a consulting firm that counsels corporations on security matters and is one of the leading advocates of mandatory vaccines for employees as a condition for employment. Members of the think tank The Project for a New American Century, PNAC, also played a key role in sounding the alarm that a biological weapons attack was certain to follow on the heels of 9/11, and then simultaneously amplified the panic and blamed Iraq following the anthrax letter attacks. PNAC's core doctrine was that, as the Cold War victor, America and U.S.-based multinationals, particularly petroleum and pharmaceutical companies, had earned the right to rule the world for a century or so. PNAC members populated virtually all of the key foreign policy posts in the Bush White House. The warmongering cabal called themselves the Vulcans in honor of their belligerent brand of U.S. imperialism. Their members included Dick Cheney, Scooter Libby, Donald Rumsfeld, Douglas Feith, Elliot Abrams, John Bolton, and Rumsfeld's advisors Richard Perl and Paul Wolfowitz. Critics called them the Chicken Hawks because, ironically, each one of them had draft dodged the Vietnam War. Osama bin Laden, the author of the World Trade Center attacks, supposedly directed that operation from an Afghan cave. But Donald Rumsfeld complained there aren't any good targets in Afghanistan. The PNAC Chicken Hawks were determined to use 9/11 as a pretext for a war against Iraq, beneath which God had mischievously stockpiled so much of America's oil. Anthrax provided that provocation. Control of global oil resources was, for PNAC, a key stepping stone for the coming century of American imperialism, and a bioweapon attack against America became the ideal provocation for preemptive invasion. It's noteworthy that Judith Miller not only covered the Dark Winter exercise for the New York Times, she was also an active planner and participant in the simulation, playing the part of a reporter. Miller was an OG germaphobe and veteran biosecurity booster. On September 4, 2001, exactly 1 week before the 9/11 attacks, Miller, excerpting from a paranoid book, Germs, she had written with Times reporters William Broad and Steve Engelberg, reported approvingly in the New York Times that the Pentagon had green-lighted a project to make a potentially more potent form of anthrax bacteria. Miller did not explain why this response seemed rational or even sane. Miller's articles repeating Pentagon and CIA claims about Saddam's bioweapons cache and his probable involvement with the anthrax attacks helped fuel the U.S. invasion of Iraq. According to New York Magazine, during the winter of 2001 and throughout 2002, Miller produced a series of stunning stories about Saddam Hussein's ambition and capacity to produce weapons of mass destruction, almost all of which have turned out to be stunningly inaccurate. Miller's jingoistic reporting, New York Magazine dubbed her Chicken Little, played such a decisive role in validating the White House warmongers' Iraq invasion agenda that the New York Times afterward made an unprecedented apology for its role in what then was arguably the worst foreign policy decision in United States history. Miller was so keen to facilitate an Iraq invasion that she illegally leaked the identity of CIA agent Valerie Plame to punish Plame's husband, State Department diplomat Joseph Wilson, who had publicly challenged White House and CIA narratives about Iraq obtaining yellowcake uranium from Niger. The CIA at that time was aggressively pushing for war. George W. Bush later said that his worst mistake during his White House years was swallowing the CIA's guarantees. The biggest regret of all the presidency has to have been the intelligence failure in Iraq. A lot of people put their reputations on the line and said the weapons of mass destruction is a reason to remove Saddam Hussein. In 2003, during the run-up to the war, CIA Director George Tenet assured President Bush that Saddam had a secret arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, WMDs. Don't worry, it's a slam dunk. Miller served 3 months in jail for contempt before she agreed to disclose the identity of her confederate, Louis Scooter Libby, VP Cheney's chief of staff. Libby, who told Miller that Plame was a clandestine CIA agent and directed her to publish the revelation, subsequently went to prison for the crime. It will be many years before the CIA releases documents explaining the agency's true relationships, if any, with Miller and Libby. Libby, a PNAC founder and key visionary and promoter of America's 100-year Reich, was an early champion of the modern biosecurity agenda, with multiple personal connections with the intelligence community at Yale, RAND, Northrop Grumman, and the Pentagon. The State Department's Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, his employer in the early 1980s, had and still has deep CIA ties. His obsession with bioterrorism led Libby to write a novel about a smallpox pandemic and earned him the White House nickname Germ Boy. Following his pardon and subsequent prison release by President Donald Trump, Libby joined Robert Kadlec's Blue Ribbon Panel for Biodefense, BRPB, which promotes biosecurity as the fulcrum of U.S. foreign policy, the 21st century as the age of U.S. empire, and mass vaccination as a foreign policy tool. Libby's fellow BRPB director, William Karish, is the executive vice president of Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance, the organization through which Dr. Fauci, Kadlec, and the Pentagon, through DARPA, were laundering gain-of-function payments to Chinese scientists in Wuhan. Libby also serves as senior vice president of the Hudson Institute, a think tank with deep connections to the pharmaceutical industry, Monsanto, and the CIA. He guides the Institute's program on national security and defense issues. In 2021, former CIA Director Mike Pompeo joined the Hudson Institute. The pervasive CIA involvement in the global vaccine putsch should give us pause. There is nothing in the CIA's history, in its charter, in its composition, or in its institutional culture that betrays an interest in promoting either public health or democracy. The CIA's historical preoccupations have been power and control. The CIA has been involved in at least 72 attempted and successful coups d'etat between 1947 and 1989, involving about a third of the world's governments. Many of these were functioning democracies. The CIA does not do public health. It does not do democracy. The CIA does coup d'etat. Smallpox, biosecurity blossoms. Dark Winter was part of a persistent campaign by the intelligence agencies and the bioweapons lobby to keep smallpox fears alive in the public consciousness. Even before the disease was eradicated in 1977, public health regulators had discontinued smallpox vaccinations in the United States. Public health advocates urged the federal bureaucracies and the military to destroy their smallpox stockpile to prevent the disease from escaping and possibly decimating humanity. Ignoring these warnings, the George W. Bush administration purchased even more. During the run-up to the Iraq War, President Bush aimed to inoculate the U.S. population with smallpox vaccines. Skeptics charged that the reckless scheme was PNAC's transparent gimmick for hyping fear of Saddam Hussein's mythological bioweapons program. Dr. Merrill Nass, writing on the history of smallpox vaccine, later reported, "The smallpox vaccine was known to be highly reactogenic. When the vaccine was given to healthcare workers and first responders in 2003, episodes of heart failure, heart attacks, myocarditis, and death quickly mounted. Doctors and nurses learned that they could not sue for damages if injured, and at first there was no federal compensation either. They began refusing to be vaccinated." The Clinton administration continued to stockpile millions of smallpox vaccines, and Congress allotted money for a compensation program, but the maximum award was only $250,000 for a permanent disability or death. After distributing 40 million inoculations, the wave of alarming injuries caused the government to abandon the project's civilian arm. The military continued vaccinating soldiers with the untested, unapproved, deadly vaccine, with catastrophic results. The vaccine caused symptomatic myocarditis in 1 in every 216 soldiers and subclinical myocarditis in 1 in 35 soldiers, according to a 2015 U.S. Army study. Government officials have since recognized vaccines as a probable culprit in the era's epidemic of Gulf War syndrome, which affected vaccinated soldiers both deployed and those vaccinated in preparation for deployment but never deployed. The court observed that absent an informed consent or presidential waiver, the United States cannot demand that members of the armed forces also serve as guinea pigs for experimental drugs. October 4th, anthrax attack. Less than 4 months after the Dark Winter simulation, and 3 weeks after 9/11, a mysterious spate of letters containing fine white anthrax spores arrived by mail at several news media outlets and the Capitol Hill offices of two senators, Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. Those two senators had been the most vocal in condemning the post-9/11 infringements on civil liberties pushed by the PNAC crowd. Administration and press accusations pegging Saddam Hussein as the probable culprit in the anthrax attacks, which killed 5 Americans, fueled Congress's hasty passage of the Patriot Act, as Michael Moore proved, Not a single elected member had read the bill, and its jingoistic declaration of war on Iraq. By abolishing traditional privacy protection, the Patriot Act created an entire terror industry, according to a 2021 report by Action Center on Race and Economy. The biggest beneficiaries have been Silicon Valley tech companies, particularly Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, who have partnered with federal intelligence agencies to mine data and profit from the war on terror by at least $44 billion since 2001. The Patriot Act passage, the report says, opened the door for big tech to become first and foremost the brokers of our personal data, selling it to secret agencies and private companies at home and abroad, unleashing the era of the digital economy. Second only to Vice President Dick Cheney, the staunchest war hawk among George W. Bush's Beltway coterie, was his Secretary of Defense, former Searle Pharmaceutical CEO and PNAC chieftain Donald Rumsfeld, the very man who 14 years earlier had given Saddam his anthrax arsenal. While no one has ever proven the origin of the anthrax in those letters, the FBI concluded that the powder had come from a U.S. military lab. Robert Kadlec was first among the large coterie of pharmaceutical companies and military contractors to benefit from the anthrax scare. Immediately after the anthrax letters arrived, Kadlec became a special advisor on biological warfare to then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his PNAC deputy, Paul Wolfowitz. Three suspects, all linked to the U.S. military. The PNAC cabal was determined to blame the anthrax attack on Saddam Hussein, and Rumsfeld's deputy, Paul Wolfowitz, tasked Kadlec with confirming the presence of bentonite in the anthrax used in the attacks. Experts had advised Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz that bentonite was a fingerprint unique to Iraqi anthrax stocks. Its presence would therefore put the blame on Saddam. Kadlec did not succeed in finding bentonite in any of the anthrax samples that the FBI tested, but repeated media reports claiming otherwise allowed warmongers to drum up jingoistic hysteria against Saddam. By late October 2001, one nationwide poll found that 74% of respondents wanted the United States to take military action against Baghdad, despite a complete lack of evidence connecting Iraq to either 9/11 or the anthrax attacks. Instead of pointing the finger at Saddam, the FBI lab found that the anthrax spores originated from one of three U.S. Army labs, Fort Detrick, a lab at the University of Scranton, or Battelle's West Jefferson facility, owned by an El Hibri business partner. The FBI closed its investigation after its leading suspect, a vaccinologist, Dr. Bruce Ivins, who ran the U.S. Army lab at Fort Detrick, allegedly took his own life. A multitude of critics of the shoddy and haphazard FBI investigation complained that Ivins was the victim of a ham-handed FBI frame. According to the FBI's former lead investigator Richard Lambert, the FBI team hid a mountain of evidence that would have exonerated Ivins. In 2008, following Ivins' untimely suicide, Department of Justice civil attorneys in Florida, defending a claim by the widow of anthrax victim Robert Stevens, publicly challenged the FBI's assertions that Ivins had been the culprit and instead pointedly suggested that a private laboratory in Ohio managed by Battelle and linked to the El Hibris could have been involved in the attacks. DOG headquarters quickly had its Florida attorneys rewrite their brief, omitting this claim. An Italian publication, Il Manifesto, reported in its October 2001 issue that the FBI had placed the El Hibris on its suspects list for sending the anthrax spores through the U.S. mail. Cui bono? Since 1995, Kadlec had been frothing about bioterrorism to War College students and urging the creation of a Strategic National Stockpile, SNS, to warehouse vaccines and other countermeasures. In 2004, with Kadlec now working for Secretary Rumsfeld at the Bush White House, Congress passed the Public Health Security and Bioterrorism Preparedness Act, which Kadlec drafted, directing the Secretary of HHS to maintain a strategic national stockpile managed jointly by DHS and HHS. The same week, Congress passed the Project BioShield Act, which Kadlec also helped draft, launching the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA, a government-operated investment bank that would germinate new technologies for Kadlec's stockpile. With Kadlec's guidance, BARDA would become a federal ATM machine for big pharma, biodefense contractors, and gain-of-function researchers, along with Dr. Fauci's NIAID and the Pentagon's DARPA. BARDA would be the other big-league funder for experiments to create pandemic superbugs in Wuhan and elsewhere. Kadlec's statute authorized the purchase of $5 billion of materiel, including vaccines, for the stockpile, creating a gold mine, as we shall see, for Kadlec's friends the El-Hibris. Another conspicuous beneficiary of the stockpile was then-Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, and Kadlec's boss, who made a killing during the 2004 fake bird flu pandemic, which Tony Fauci ginned up, with his confederate, an ambitious young British physician and Wellcome Trust researcher, Jeremy Farrar. 16 years later, as director of Wellcome Trust, Farrar would play a key role in the 2020 Wuhan cover-up. The Pentagon in 2004 and 2005, in response to Farrar's concocted contagion, stockpiled 80 million doses of Gilead's flu remedy Tamiflu. Secretary Rumsfeld had served on the board of Gilead from 1988 to 2001 and was its chairman from 1997 until he joined the Bush administration as defense secretary. He retained stock in the pharmaceutical company, which netted him a $5 million profit from the Tamiflu run-up. George Shultz, another PNAC war hawk, also hit the jackpot, cashing in $7 million of Gilead stock during the Tamiflu run-up. The biggest winners, however, were the El-Hibris. The anthrax attacks brought them exoneration, salvation, and extravagant windfalls. Bioport's rebirth and reinvention as emergent biosolutions. Anthrax arrived just in time for the El-Hibris. Bioport was by then on the ropes. The El-Hibris anthrax vaccine facility was facing bankruptcy and the loss of its operating license. Bioport's Pentagon contract expired in August 2001, with a host of outstanding accounting mysteries impeding its renewal. The Pentagon had given Bioport millions to renovate its factory, but much of that money instead financed senior management bonuses and an opulent makeover for the El-Hibris executive offices. Millions more simply disappeared, according to journalist Whitney Webb. In 2000, not long after receiving its first Pentagon bailout, Bioport contracted none other than Battelle Memorial Institute to cultivate its anthrax seed stock. Kadlec's boss, Donald Rumsfeld, told aides that his biosecurity priority after the incidents of anthrax sent through the mail was rescuing Bioport. "We're going to try to save it and try to fashion some sort of an arrangement whereby we give one more crack at getting the job done with that outfit. It's the only outfit in this country that has anything underway, and it's not very well underway, as you point out."